Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. We're doing things differently. We're starting off the year with new kind of approach to things. So we're not going to be taking a look at what happened on this day in history. Last week, we took a look at strange laws around the world. This week, we're going to be taking a look at interesting celebrity middle names. We'll start with an easy one to get you off and get you comfortable in the space. The original name of the celebrity was Reginald Kenneth Dwight. The more commonly known name today is now Sir Elton Hercules John. Interesting change that happened there. Interesting middle name now gone from Kenneth to Hercules. I wonder why. I wonder what the thought process was around that. Perhaps someone would ask him and perhaps we'd get feedback somewhere. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at the disposal decision by Reinet, the Luxembourg-based investment firm, to dispose of their stake in British American Tobacco. Very interesting timing on that transaction. We're going to speak to portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, Tato Mashego, around that. Then we've got a conversation with the economist and founder at Pan-African Investments, Dr. Iraj Abedin, about the latest Future of Jobs report that came out from the World Economic Forum. The World Economic Forum is gathering at Davos next week, but ahead of that, they put out a very interesting jobs report on the future of jobs. We're going to look at that and the labor market insights that are being provided through from that perspective. Then we've got a conversation around the tech tax. It's a very interesting tax that has been in place for quite some time in South Africa on almost all electronics that are imported into South Africa. There seems to be about a 9% tax on that. We're going to speak to a tax specialist around that and try and figure out why that is and perhaps what's going to happen there. We've seen some ministers lobby for that tax to be reduced or removed entirely, but we don't know what's happening there. We're going to find out what's happening there. We're going to speak to a tax specialist from Forvis Mazars around that, and then we're going to wrap things up with an agri segment. Today's Agri Tuesdays, we're going to be speaking to the Competition Commission around their findings and recommendations on the fresh produce market. They launched this inquiry and investigation around 2021, 2022-ish. We are now in 2025. We've finally got recommendations and conclusions from this particular inquiry. We're going to speak to the Comcom around that and understand where we go from here.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We get things going, as always, with a sense of how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Head of Research at F&B Wealth and Investments, Chantal Marks, to take a look at today's market movements. Good evening, Chantal. Lovely to catch up with you, as always. Interesting day today. I thought we'd have a stronger day, but in general, I thought we'd have a stronger start to the year. Last week, markets were down about 2.2% on the top 40. This week, yesterday, we started off in a bearish territory. Today, we looked like we were recovering, but late afternoon movements, particularly when the US session opened up, had other plans. What's going on?
Well, I think the start of the year really has been a function of the market rethinking their stance on US rate cuts and then rate cuts globally generally. If rates are going down, interest rates are going down, that's generally supportive for economic growth and the equity market. And if there are less rate cuts than expected, then you usually see a repricing in risk assets. That would include the bond market as well as the equity market. And that's why we've had a softish stance. The Fed has turned a little bit more hawkish. Economic growth in the US has been exceptionally strong. And that is why we've seen the equity market, both locally and abroad, stuttering somewhat. I was also surprised today. I also thought we would have a generally stronger day. We started off quite strongly. The market popped up really nicely at the open, but then faded as the day progressed. And as you said, when the US market opened, we actually saw a sizable move downwards. Still managed to close in positive territory, but the mid-cap and small-cap index, as well as financials, dragging the overall market a little bit. That's the SA Inc. stable. And then the resources sector also continuing to disappoint. I am praying for a turnaround at this point in commodity stocks.
Chantal, when we look at the markets and we look at South Africa versus the global markets, I mean, we look at Asian markets, they were all in the green, and South African markets typically do follow on from what kind of happens in Asian markets in terms of sentiment, and that does filter through from a demand side as well on the commodity side, as you mentioned. But looking at the US picture, and obviously that big surprise coming in from the US Fed in December saying that we are anticipating less rate cuts in 2025 as opposed to what the market had initially expected, is that something that's going to likely be affected by the inauguration come this time next week? I mean, we know that Donald Trump has been very vocal around things like having the right people in the right positions, and this includes a willingness to put Jerome Powell's head on the chopping block if he doesn't do what Donald Trump wants him to do. Is there some level of volatility that the market is trying to anticipate to say this situation could change depending on what happens after next week?
Yeah, so I do think we need to start expecting the unexpected when it comes to Donald Trump. And a lot of it has to do with what he might do, but a lot of it also has to do with what he might say, because sometimes the bark is worse than the bite. And particularly when it comes to market sentiment, markets don't like uncertainty. And I think we will probably see a heightened sense of volatility there. I mean, as far as those powers extend towards any sort of personnel changes at the Fed, I also think it's a bit overblown at this point. Powell is likely to serve out his term, and monetary policy is monetary policy. There really shouldn't be much of a state intervention in that. I think the risk is greater that when you intervene, you might break something rather than just letting monetary authorities do what they are supposed to do. But I do think that as we get these comments coming through from Trump, whether it's through official channels or through Twitter, we'll probably see the market react to all of it.
Somehow, I don't think Donald Trump is too worried about what he breaks on his way into the White House, particularly because it is his last time going into the White House. Chantal, I want to look at some of the local movements. If we look at the telecoms companies, I mean, the likes of MTN, Vodacom, both having really good days today. But again, on the other side of the biggest losers of the day, some mining companies as well, as you said, resources, commodities, coming under quite a bit of pressure. What are you looking at this stage in terms of what could potentially provide value? I mean, I see the likes of the PIC out there doubling down on PGMs. What's catching your eye at the moment from a South African perspective?
Yeah, I'll just mention quickly the move on the telecoms today and my interpretation of it. It was actually, I think, two separate pieces of news. So MTN announced that Nigeria has approved a massive price increase in that country. So obviously that will be quite positive for them. I also saw a broker upgrade there. And then Vodacom has reached an agreement with Orange, the French telecoms company, to expand services in the DRC. And we know the DRC, even though it's an underpenetrated market, it's a massive addressable market because of the large population there. So I think some interesting develops there on the telecom space. Are they my favorites for the year ahead? Probably not. So where I think there's quite a bit of value at the moment is actually in the Rand hedge stable. So the Rand hedges have greatly underperformed over the last year or so. We've seen a good resurgence from SA Inc. Where I still think there's a little bit of value, although we've missed the initial upside. But I think the Rand hedges look particularly interesting. And with particular reference to Naspers, Prosus, Richemont, I think AB InBev offers value currently. Bidcorp is one of my favorites for the year ahead. Yeah, I mean, I think that you'll still continue to find pockets of value in the mid-cap and small-cap space, particularly given the weakness that we've seen so far in the first few trading days of 2025.
Speaking of the Rand, Chantal, we broke above 19 Rand. We're very concerned there. At some point, it would look like we were heading towards 20 Rand against the US dollar. We're back below 19 Rand. That volatility, I imagine, will continue in the days to come until we kind of have a bit more clarity around the US picture and what is going to happen with the dollar strength. But from a South African perspective, we also have our own MPC meeting coming up later this month. What are we anticipating that meeting will do to the value of the Rand?
Yeah, I mean, it's been quite an interesting ride for the Rand so far this year. So even though the Rand has weakened, it's kind of middle of the pack for the year so far. And if we look at today, we actually saw some really nice strength, the fourth strongest currency against the US dollar among the majors today. I think that when we look at the rate story, if we are not going to see further rate cuts by the Fed, but we see further rate cuts by the SARB, you could probably expect the rand to weaken. And the flip side is also true. If we hold the line in line with the Fed, then we will probably see some strength in the rand. I'm not sure what the right answer is. Yeah, my sense is that this economy actually needs looser monetary policy in order for us to see that much anticipated uptick in growth through this year. So I would hope that we could stomach the short-term rand weakness, because most of the rand weakness is actually due to dollar strength. It's not something specific that we've done wrong. And hopefully we still get some cuts from the Fed, and that will give our SARB some room to also put through those much needed cuts, because our economy is in a much more precarious state than the US economy that just seems to be pumping along.
Mm. Chantal, how do you balance that? From a monetary policy perspective, you don't want to kind of be seen to be doing what other monetary policy or other countries and central banks are doing, but at the same time, you don't want to kind of decouple too far from what's happening. Understanding, of course, our situation is very unique. We can't afford to hold out and say, oh, maybe we'll get a third rate cut from the US. The US's economy is not going to really care too much about our economy and the performance of our economy. So as a central bank, how do you make that decision to say, you know what, maybe we will loosen monetary policy a bit because that's in the best interests of South Africa and it might weaken the rand?
Yeah, I mean, you need to look at real rates, you need to look at inflation differentials and interest rate differentials generally, and then you need to consider what the inflation picture looks like. Because ultimately, the South African Reserve Bank has an inflation mandate. So if you are going to cut rates when the US is not cutting rates and you see a weakening in the rand, you can import inflation. So it's very, very important for them to remain cognizant of that. And I think that it plays a massive role. And that's probably why you see them seemingly following the Fed, because it just reduces the risk of having a rand blowout and resulting in a spike in inflation, because we do import inflation, mainly because we're an oil importer. So there's nothing we can do about imported inflation. And if the rand is weak, that inflation is probably going to increase, unless local demand is so poor that you don't actually see that push up in prices. So yeah, it's a balancing act, but it's all quite scientific as well. You just have to watch the rand quite closely, and for that reason, you have to watch what the Fed is doing.
Well, that monetary policy committee meeting is taking place next week, I believe. If not next week, possibly the week after that. I'll just confirm that on the SARB's website, and hopefully we get some good news from that. Chantal, thanks so much for the time and for the insights, as always. Chantal Marks, Head of Research at FNB Wealth and Investments, on the market movements throughout the day, as well as what could potentially be driving South African markets.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
With the benefit of hindsight, investors would undoubtedly do better. But the reality is that the future is always uncertain and risks always abound. That said, the past holds some important lessons. Tune into the SAFM Market Update tomorrow evening at 6:45, as Rory Kutiska-Jacobson, Portfolio Manager at Allan Gray, joins us to explore how 2024, the great election year, has shaped the current opportunity set for long-term investors. Brought to you by Allan Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investment. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That Monetary Policy Committee date is the 30th of January. So the end of January, we will have the announcement around what's happening with our interest rates. It's the first meeting of the year. The one that will follow that will be in March. But we move on to our story around Raynet disposing of their stake in British American Tobacco. Very interesting developments from this perspective. The stake was worth around $1.5 billion or just shy of 30 billion rand. And we're going to be taking a look at the transaction itself, the decision behind this, and why it's happening at this time. I'm joined on the line by portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, Tato Mashego, to take a look at this. And Tato Mashego, good evening. Thanks so much for taking the time to chat to us. This is a very interesting transaction because you don't often see a company unwind its entire stake in a business all at once, and on top of that, at the discount that Reinet did. Your initial thoughts around the sell or the decision to sell out of BAT?
Well, good evening, Jimmy. It is an interesting transaction indeed. I think it has somewhat been on the cards for a number of years, and management has guided to the fact that the weighting of British American Tobacco within the Reinet stable would decline over time as the other assets grew in value. So that has been quite known for some time, but the complete exiting, of course, may have been somewhat of a surprise, but it has obviously been received quite favorably by the market, as evidenced by the share price movement today.
Mm. Tato, when we look at the transaction from Reinet's side of it, I mean, selling out their 2% stake in BAT at a 4% discount. Now, 4% discount doesn't seem like a lot for some people, but given that we are talking about almost 44 million shares, that is a significant size there. And doing it all at once, willing to take that discount, is there an element of urgency that's worrying you here around wanting to just get out of the entire position size? Or is it something that seems fairly common around the strategy that Reinet's been pursuing lately?
Well, I wouldn't say there would be worry around the discount to the market price. Of course, given the large quantum, a discount can be negotiated, which is not unusual. So they did opt to do a book build with institutional investors, and they offloaded the position within a day or so. Some of it on market was offloaded over 2 months ending last year, but the bulk of the position, about £1.2 billion, I believe, was offloaded via book build. So it's fairly standard for there to be a slight discount. So I wouldn't see it so much as a panic. I think perhaps the bigger question would, of course, be the discount to NAV and them exiting at this position, and how shareholders feel about that. But of course, with the resulting performance of the price, obviously shareholders are more than happy for them to exit at that discount, and you've seen it's closing slightly with the share price movement today.
Mm. Tato, the Reinet family has said that they will be using the proceeds to continue their ongoing investing activities. When you look at this transaction and perhaps other transactions that are taking place across the world, I mean, we've seen quite a bit of uptick in M&A activity and interest in certain transactions. Are you seeing that these kinds of transactions, where it comes to sort of portfolio realignments and freeing up assets or freeing up cash where it relates to assets you no longer want to be invested in, are you seeing these becoming more and more prevalent, whether it's from an investing firm like Reinet or even from companies that have just fixed assets that they want to get rid of?
Well, I would say it's a very pivotal moment for the company and in the life cycle of any investment holding company, when you have an asset which is a large portion of your overall portfolio. Disposing of that asset and then reallocating the capital has a significant impact on the long-term value towards shareholders. So this is definitely one of those moments for Reinet. You know, they're now sitting on 30% cash in terms of the overall business. And how that's allocated is going to determine how this company performs over the next decade, I believe. So we do know they've ruled out the special dividend or, you know, returning capital to shareholders. So this is going to go into either reallocating in the existing portfolio or into new assets. And it's not entirely certain where or what decision they're going to make, but obviously it is a strategic one. Where if they introduce new assets, you know, the makeup of those assets, listed versus unlisted, which industry, geography. So there's a lot of questions, I think, at the moment. And we'll have to obviously wait and see exactly what the new RENET is going to look like.
A couple of weeks ago, possibly late last year, or actually towards the middle of last year, going into late last year, we saw Warren Buffett do the exact same thing with Berkshire, liquidating out of Apple positions and reducing, well, not liquidating, but yes, significantly reducing his exposure to Apple and Coca-Cola and other staple shares that he's had in his portfolio for the longest time. Is this that turning point in the market in general? Is that something you're seeing from a portfolio perspective, that there are some of these big, big, big moves that are happening with companies electing to sit on 30, 40% cash, waiting for the right opportunities?
Well, I'd say definitely with regards to the Berkshire move that you mentioned, it could be seen as a market signal, Apple being one of the largest companies globally, and the valuation of Apple, along with some of the other, you know, large consumer staples that you mentioned, like Coca-Cola, maybe being brought into question, given their historically high multiples. So that definitely can be seen perhaps as a signal from a well-known investor that the market might be a bit frothy at this point. In the case of British American Tobacco, it might be a bit harder to make that case. A lot of people would argue that there is some value in the company where it's currently priced, given its dividend yield and so on and so forth. So maybe the reasoning might be slightly different. Of course, if RENET decides to hold on to cash for an extended period of time, that in itself could be a signal in terms of how they view the market pricing at the moment.
Mm. Tato, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts on the cash side of it. The US has announced that we're going to be seeing less rate cuts than expected, meaning we're going to have better dollar returns for longer. Could this be something else that's driving some institutional investment to say markets have run in certain industries, in certain sectors, and sitting on free US cash, which hasn't happened in a long time, is potentially another consideration?
I suppose it is a consideration. We do see selling off of longer term, you know, U.S. debt, and, you know, seeing bond yields at, you know, around 4.8%, and continued inflows into equity markets, which perhaps is a signal around some jitteriness with regards to where deficits are in the U.S. But the shorter term cash, as you mentioned, that is somewhat of an attractive option, given where rates are, assuming that we don't get significant cuts this year from the Fed. So that is a strategy which investors have utilized in the past 1 or 2 years, which may continue going forward, especially if one feels that we've had a significant run in some of the equity assets in specific sectors like technology. So hiding in cash in the short term may not be a bad strategy, and we may see some of these larger, whether it's holding companies or other institutions, adopting that strategy. So that is one to watch, I think.
Sitting on cash might not be the worst thing at this point in time. It certainly isn't for a RENET that's disposed of their stake in British American Tobacco. I think we'll leave the conversation there. Tato, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Tato Mashego, Portfolio Manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, on the disposal from RENET of their BAT holdings.
Affordable data is more than just a convenience. It's a real catalyst for change. In the latest Fix SA episode, I talked to George Mendez, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Cell C, about the telco industry's role in driving inclusive economic growth. From empowering underserved communities to fostering entrepreneurship, connectivity is unlocking potential and creating opportunities.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's just gone 6:30. You're tuning into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha, and we're taking a look at the future of jobs, at least according to the World Economic Forum. They put up a future of jobs report ahead of their gathering next week in Davos, and we're going to be taking a look at the report and trying to make sense of it. I'm joined on the line by economist and founder at Pan African Investments, Dr. Iraj Abedian. To take a look at this, Dr. Iraj, thanks so much for taking the time. Interesting report by the World Economic Forum. What does it suggest about the labor market landscape, both locally, but more so, I suppose, internationally as well?
Yeah, first of all, Jimmy, and a compliment of the citizen to you and to our listeners. In terms of this report, World Economic Forum, it's important to note that it's not just World Economic Forum that has come with this type of predictions and insight into the future of job markets globally. Almost all the institutions of research more or less repeat the same message, that the nature of jobs right across the spectrum, from the least to the most skilled, we used to call it unskilled, semi-skilled, skilled, that kind of categorization is no longer really a proper description of the spectrum. But be as it may, all these categories of jobs are going to be fundamentally affected by digitalization, by generative artificial intelligence, and by the reconceptualization of the workplace. During the COVID, we got used to working offline and all of that. That is tip of the iceberg. Many of the jobs, possibly 40-45% of jobs as we know them, the front desk or frontline opportunities, administrative, clerical, and so on, are either going to be completely wiped out, not be needed, the same way that you and I, we don't know typewriters anymore, and typists don't exist in the sense that I remember it. So that is the message. The message is that when we think of jobs, we need to think very differently. We need to think systems. We need to think apps. We need to think automation and, importantly, digitalization and systematization of the various nodes of job markets. So it's a very profound message for everybody, but especially the young ones. There are other aspects to it that we can also discuss.
One of those aspects is the skills. What does this shift then say about the skills that are going to become in demand? Because as you say, we no longer have things like typewriters, and we are starting to automate things a lot more, which therefore suggests that new skills are going to be required. We're shifting from the traditional skills that were in demand 10, 15, 20 years ago to a new skill set. What kinds of skills are we looking at for the future?
Fundamentally, it's about analytical skills, skills that are into creating apps, re-automating the processes, and that basically means analytical. It means software development. It means integration, ingestion of data, big data management, databases that are global, not even local, and ability, technical as well as analytical, as well as conceptual of how we can use the big data for all kinds of use, from medical use to marketing use to production use, etc., etc. So the shift, Jamie, as I understand it, is going to move from the frontline, low-skilled, repetitive to skill-intensive, knowledge-intensive, and analysis or analytics-intensive end of the market. So it's going to be fundamental. It's not going to be a marginal 10%, 20%. A lot of frontline, low analysis, admin, clerical are going to disappear, and a whole lot of bulking is going to happen at the far extreme end of the analytics. And that means quite a massive change in distribution of income. It means a massive change in the age distribution of those who are wanted. At the same time, it's going to extend the job years of being in a job. So 55, 65, that was the age of retirement, may well extend way beyond that, which means that at the lower entry level, we may have a bulking up of the unemployment, and that's going to have both socioeconomic implications as well as political implications.
Dr. Iraj, how then does a country prepare for this? I mean, you're an economist. You look at kind of where economies grow and how economies get things going, how then do economies like South Africa prepare for this, understanding that things like AI, as you said, are new sectors and new markets that we still need to then build out in South Africa? How do you then ensure that your economy is equipped to transition with this change in work and ensure that you do have sort of a future-proof environment?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I wish I knew. Let me be absolutely honest, because it's changing so fast that in the next 5 years, we're going to see more changes in this space than we've had over the past 50 years and over the past 20 years. So the pace at which that is changing make it extremely difficult to answer your question in terms of how do we predict, because how do we do it assumes that I know what's going to be like in 5 years' time, which we don't. And with greatest humility, Jimmy, I would admit very few people, if anybody, knows. Number two, we need to rethink in a fundamental way our so-called education system and change the schooling and education system as conventionally known since the advent of Industrial Revolution to human resource development, which means we need to prepare our younger generations to think of a very different kind of acquiring knowledge, applying knowledge, and networking what they know and what they do not know. So that means the shift of education in each country, especially countries like us, which we have our own challenges in any case with our education system. With respect, if you just highlight so that I'm not philosophizing, we're still thinking, our politicians and our policymakers thinking, whether the school should have toilet or not and how quickly we can make a sanitary space for our education and safe, as opposed to bringing and extending the whole concept into human resource development from cradle to grave, so to speak, so that our youngsters are made aware and helped and assisted in developing their analytical space very early on, not just through 6 or 7 hours of schooling. So it's a fundamental shift in our human resource development strategy before formal schooling, during schooling, and post-schooling, and after having a job. I've had to be honest, I've had to, over the past 10 years, reinvent myself 3-4 times. Every time that the technology changes, my field is affected. So I need to either keep up with it or I'll be blown away. So, and that is the challenge for countries such as South Africa, that we have to change the discourse. We need to understand the urgency of time. We need to look at immediate interventions in a whole range of areas that relate to and enable human resource development, for example, broadband accessibility, et cetera, et cetera. And therefore, I would say that's where our immediate challenge lies.
The only constant in life is change, and that is what the report suggests. We will have to leave the conversation there. Dr. Iraj, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Dr. Iraj Abedian, who is an economist and founder of Pan-African Investments, on the latest Future of Jobs report put out by the World Economic Forum that shows a couple of shifts happening and a couple of things that we need to rethink when we're looking at the future of jobs.
I've been speaking to Ian Chen, who's the CEO of Trust Wallet. That's got 160 million users worldwide. And we've been talking about this whole trend towards self-custody that's happening around the world. A lot of people prefer to keep their coins on a crypto exchange. It's convenient. But is it safe?
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
If you've ever bought anything like a smartphone, a gaming console, some headphones, even a digital camera, you might find that you can find them a lot cheaper outside of South Africa, but somehow in South Africa, they are considerably more expensive. This might be due to a luxury tax that is or an ad valorem tax that has been imposed on electronic goods. It is something that affects almost all of our electronic goods that we import in South Africa, and we're going to find out why. I'm joined on the line by Senior Manager for Tax Consulting at Forvis Mazars, Ivadna Bronkhorst, to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Ivadna. Thanks so much for taking the time. This seems like something that we probably should have known about a long time. When did this electronics tax start?
Good evening, Jimmy, and thank you for allowing me to share my views and thoughts. While the whole rationale behind ad valorem excise taxes is to focus on your more luxury goods, so it's not always very transparent how certain products were determined to be luxury goods. For example, economic studies have shown that even if you increase the gross net pay per household, even the lower income households would prefer to spend the additional funds on, for example, purchasing a television because it provides them a means of escape instead of buying healthier food. So even if there's tax incentives to promote the consumption of healthy food, some items are classified as luxury goods, and therefore this can be seen as a form of a wealth tax. It's been implemented since the existence of customs and excise duties were introduced in South Africa, and it's in Schedule 2B of the tariff book to the Customs and Excise Act.
Now, when we look at some of the items that are affected from an electronic point of view, I'm looking at something like smartphones, because the communications minister has recently looked at this. Companies like Vodacom have looked at this. Every household kind of uses smartphones more so as a necessity than a luxury today. And that's one of the arguments that was made by the communications minister around why that particular item should be removed from being considered as a luxury item. How do we define where to draw the line? I mean, some of these items are necessary, especially if we're moving into a digital age where businesses are run on electronic components and all of that. We no longer live in the days where things were written down on paper and all of that. Everything has become electronic. So why then is this still a tax?
Yes, I totally agree with you, but this is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, if you look at the ad valorem excise tax, that's only 9%. On importation, there's no customs duties paid on importation of smartphones, but you will still pay the ad valorem excise tax, whether or not the goods are manufactured in South Africa or even imported into South Africa. But there are other matters that also impact on the cost of these items. Like, for example, you have to add on to the added tax value amount 15% VAT. And I mean, compare 15% VAT of the cost price of an item added to that. That must be multiplied by 1.1%, and then also add the ad valorem excise duties. That 15% has a much greater cost impact. And then also think about the fact that post-COVID, there has been a lot of volatility in the exchange rates. So not even in the technology space, everywhere, everything is getting more expensive, especially for South Africans. The cost of living has increased significantly. And then one also has to talk about this will only play a small contribution in creating access, which I do believe is a necessity and is important, because when I went to school, I mean, that was when computers were just introduced. I'm getting my age away now, but these days, most of the schools and even some of the public schools require access to technology in the form of a tablet. And there's a lot of the parents and caretakers that cannot keep up with that and cannot actually afford that. And it's not about only creating access to the device. It's about being able to operate that, and that's where the cost of data comes in. So this is just a small step towards making digital technology more accessible to everyone. And I do believe, especially because it is a requirement in the educational system, that it has become a necessity, and that those that do not have readily access and cannot operate it because they cannot afford to buy data is being impacted negatively because they can't perform the nature and type of research that is required, for example, to complete an assignment. But then you think about, okay, what happens immediately if someone tries to lower the cost? The sellers would then say, okay, cool, I can just make more profit. So there should also be regulation of the prices, and I'm not talking about price setting or something like that, but there should also be some kind of regulation in place, not focusing only on the device itself, but also on the cost of operating that device. And one of the mechanisms that can greatly contribute, if you look at a country like Nigeria, 99% of the smartphones are being imported. So one key point that I want to make is that there's tax incentives that are being introduced. For example, the tax incentive on creating the hydrocarbon and, electric motor vehicles. But that is not something that I feel that is, at this point in time, necessary for South African consumers. What about the smartphones? If you can produce smartphones locally, it will be a great step towards making it more affordable and accessible to a greater part of the market and giving everyone equitable access to something that, as you mentioned, has become such a large part of our lives.
Evadna, when we look at some of the other ad valorem taxes, I mean, there are taxes on things like vehicles above a certain value and all of that. So clearly we can still make revenue from an excise perspective for the receiver of revenue if we do go back on this particular tax. But it is also important to say that we can sacrifice a little bit of revenue for the sake of improving access, as you mentioned, and growing our economy.
Yes and no. I must be honest that somewhere you have to make a decision on what is the purpose of a specific tax. Why am I imposing a specific tax? And yes, a lot of taxes are being imposed as a source of revenue, and rightly so. But every time you introduce an incentive or you take away something, you have to procure those taxes from some or other source. So the first question that comes to mind is, okay, remove the ad valorem excise taxes on smartphones. How is government going to fill that gap in addition to introducing additional tax incentives and with the budget speeds upcoming? And I mean, if you think about something like a motor vehicle, the ad valorem excise tax, after that, the carbon taxes that have increased significantly. I just feel there are taxes being added to certain items that it's actually, in my view, an archaic system. I don't believe that the focus is exactly how it should have been. Previously, one of the methods before the multinational approach to trade and global trade and the OECD and all the international agreements, customs duties and excise duties were seen as a key source of revenue for a government. But since the globalization of all transactions and the digitalization of transactions and international agreements being concluded, a lot of the customs duties have either reduced to null, or there are certain agreements in place to make sure that the level of the duty being imposed is being managed. So the key focus is facilitating global trade. And I do think that the ad valorem excise duties is an archaic system, and that its necessity should be re-evaluated in light of most recent developments.
What was the initial intended purpose of the tax, and is it still relevant? Those are the questions that need to be asked. We'll leave the conversation there. Ivadna, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Ivadna Bronkhorst, who is the senior manager for tax consulting at Forvis Mazars, on the tech tax that's been in place for quite some time.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And it's time for Agri Tuesday. We're going to be taking a look at the recommendations put out by the Competition Commission around the fresh produce market. This has been something they've been investigating for a number of years. Now the investigation has concluded. The report is out and their recommendations are there. I'm joined on the line by senior analyst at the Competition Commission, Derek Bowles, to take a look at this. Good evening, Derek. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with a recap. I mean, it has been a number of years. Take us through why the initial investigation was launched in the first place.
Hi there, Jimmy. I suppose the genesis of this inquiry was off the back of the price, or at least the food inflation hike that we saw post-COVID. And I think that raised some concerns from us. We did have a look at it initially, and we were concerned around the price gates, the farm gates and the retail margin spread, and concerned really around, whether there was perhaps any issues around price transmission through that value chain. So essentially what that meant, we were worried about what the farmers were getting for the produce that they were producing, and whether the retailers at least were making larger margins than what they should have been. So I think one of the key findings in the inquiry in that regard at least was that that's not the case. So there was issues around the gross margins for retailers. But I think, just off the back of their, massive cost base in providing, consumers the value that they get from the retailers, I suppose, that comes at a significant cost. So that was really the genesis of it. But I think we went a little bit broader than that. We looked at the entire value chain. So we went from your inputs, so, fertilizers, seeds, and crop protection products, all the way down through the value chain, to the retailers. So, but I think one of the key findings coming out of this, and I don't know if you want to chat about it, but, it's certainly something that sticks with me, is the importance or the significance of the national fresh produce markets. So if you look at what the issues around the world were, where, there was complaints largely from farmers that they were getting exploited by the retailers. And the reality is that they simply didn't have another alternative route to market. I think what makes the South African market so unique is that we've got these national fresh produce markets, which are commission-based markets, and essentially they provide a service to the consumers and to growers as well, in the sense that the whole idea behind them is that a small bucky producer can go offload a bucky load of cabbages and sell those alongside a large commercial farmer at these national fresh produce markets. And I think, that provides a unique opportunity for small growers and emerging farmers, but it also provides a disciplining factor in the market. We see that the retailers and the growers actually have quite a good relationship, and there certainly weren't some of the traditional concerns that we were anticipating seeing in that, based mostly because of the disciplining factor that these national fresh produce markets present to the market. But I think what it was of concern to us post the inquiry is just the state of these national fresh produce markets. Unfortunately, they are municipally run, most of them. I think Cape Town is the outlier in the sense that they're once privately owned. There's a PPP in place there, and I think that's really the model that we think, as the Commission, is probably the preferred model. We did address that in our recommendations, but I think a large focus for us, at least, was on getting these NFPMs, as they colloquially referred to as, back up and running, because they do provide such an important service and role within that entire value chain.
Derek, let's look at some of those other recommendations. I mean, obviously, wanting to protect, whether it's the consumer side of it, whether it's competition side of it, just protecting the sector as a whole is always a priority of the Competition Commission. And as you said, the ability to see the differences in how the different models are working. What are some of the other recommendations that came through from the investigations?
Well, there was one recommendation which I suppose stands out in terms of the retailers in that, and it's more from a consumer protection basis, where we were a little concerned around pricing transparency and the ability of your average consumer to compare prices, across a product line, within that retail space. So as an example, comparing the price of tomatoes at Checkers, relative to the price at Pick and Pay and so on and so forth. So I think we did look at that, and I think what we decided to do there is put in place a uniform pricing standard. And I think some of it has come through within the retailers. I won't mention names, but where you've got a specific price per gram, price per 100 grams, whatever that might be, so that the consumers can make accurate comparisons. That is one that stands out, with regards to the retailers. Another one, which I think is quite controversial at this moment is the divestiture order with African Rainbow Capital. And I think that largely stems from a concentration issue at that market agency level, where, we are seeing, evidence of an oligopoly in place there, where the market is essentially run and controlled by the big four, so to speak. So, we were concerned about the concentration issues there, and African Rainbow Capital, has a significant stake in the two largest market agencies. And from a structural perspective, I think that was a concern to us. So we have imposed a divestiture order there where we require ARC to divest either shareholding in Subtropica or the RSA group. Just then in terms of, back to the NFPMs and there, we were trying to introduce, HDP market agents. That market is incredibly concentrated, as I indicated. And I think we're trying to, see how we can get more effective participation with small market agents and specifically HDP market agents, historically disadvantaged persons. And so there are recommendations around that imposing, some sort of management arrangement with the incumbent market agencies to try and stimulate some sort of entry into that market. Another one which is of particular interest is, trying to get growers, growers is your farmers to participate more, and especially your emerging farmers, and being able to get them into those markets more effectively and participating there. I mean, I think what we did notice, we did, workshops around the country, specifically targeting and visiting, emerging farmers around the country. And I think as the technical team, at least, it was one of the most profound sort of memories and lasting memories from this inquiry, is just seeing the difficulties that those emerging farmers are faced with, considering where these NFPMs are located and the cost involved in getting their produce at scale to an NFPM, because unfortunately they are, wouldn't say excluded from the large retailers. The retailers are making great strides in incorporating them into their value chains, but the difficulty that these guys face is simply that they can't produce at scale, and the volume, that the volume requirements to supply to your large retailers and get produce to their DCs, to get on the shelves is incredibly hard for these guys. So that was one of the key elements to this inquiry, and it formed part of our theme three, which was, largely a barriers to entry sort of assessment and analysis.
In a market where there is so much going on, it's always nice to see the Competition Commission looking out for the little guys, creating fair market environments and creating equal opportunities for all, especially in the fresh produce space. We'll leave the conversation there, Derek. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Derek Bowles, Senior Analyst at the Competition Commission, on their recommendations around the fresh produce market following their investigations.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Just like that, we've come to the end of our show. If you've missed any of our conversations, they are up online as podcasts. You know exactly where to find them. You know where to follow me on all socials. It's coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Hurst is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.